It's really great to have Jill with us. Jill's an amazing person. She always inspires me. I love hearing her teach, so I'm just going to hand straight over.
I'm just going to explain why I'm here today. As some of you may know, Colin last week started his three-week series on the Blessed Life, which is based on a book that he read by a guy called Robert Morris. But unfortunately, he can't be here today because he's away for the weekend, so I very tentatively offered to step in for him. So I'm attempting to follow his notes and his PowerPoint and try and communicate what he wanted to communicate with you. So this is my version of Colin's version of Robert Morris's version of The Blessed Life, Part 2. And as you will see, we're looking at three M's today: multiplication, mammon, and motives. Easy for you to say. Okay, so if we... I have to move on with this. That's it. Okay, so to recap what Colin spoke about last week, he talked about the firstborn and the first fruits. Basically, a whole idea of putting God first in our lives and applying that to the way we give as well, that the fact that we give the first... our first thing is to give to God rather than keeping for it for ourselves. And he talked a little about tithing as well. Now, this week, I'm going to start where he left off, where he was talking about grace and law, with particularly with reference to tithing. Now, we might say that now we live not under law, but under grace. But Jesus said, "I didn't come to abolish the law, I came to fulfill the law." So what does that mean? Now, Colin gave these two examples last week to you. The law says, do not murder, but grace says, do not be angry. The law says, do not commit adultery, but grace says, do not have lust in your heart. So the law was always intended to actually lead us to a place of grace. But the law can only tell us what our outward actions should be. Grace deals with what's in our heart, and Jesus deals with what's in our heart, and that's where it differs. So the law is not irrelevant, but the law is meant to lead us to that place of grace, and it's only as we deal with what's in our heart, and it's only as we allow God to transform our heart, that we can start to walk in that grace and start to walk in the blessed life that God has for us. So how does this apply to tithing, okay, and to giving? Well, tithing in the Old Testament said that you must give 10% of what you earn. Grace says, I want you to be generous in your giving. I want you to have a generous heart. I want you to give willingly, to give happily as a response to God. So it's a heart response to God rather than following a law. Now, a lot of numbers in the Bible have symbolic significances. And, for instance, number 7 is a symbolic of perfection. Number 10 is apparently symbolic of testing. So, for instance, we have the 10 plagues of Egypt, which I had fun teaching to the children last week in sub. And we have the 10 commandments. So when God says, I want a tenth of your giving, it's a bit of a test of our hearts as where do our hearts lie? Are we willing to give? Do we want to respond to God, to give back to him what he has given to us? So it's a little bit of a test. Now, while we're on the subject of tithing, I'm going to be perfectly honest with you. When I was reading through Colin's notes, there were a couple of things later on in his notes about tithing, and I thought, I'm not sure about that. So it challenged me to look up everything that the Bible has to say about tithing. So I looked up every single reference that I could find about tithing. And some of it was quite difficult to relate to our situation today. Some of the stuff, as you know, in Leviticus and Deuteronomy, that are all about tithing, I found quite difficult. But then I came across this passage in 2 Corinthians chapter 31, which I'm going to read to you today. Because I actually found this a very, very helpful picture of tithing working as it should, tithing working at its best. And I think that you'll see from this the relevance to our situation today. Now, I'm going to give you the background to it. It's the story of when Hezekiah had just become king of Judah. Now, Hezekiah was a great king. I have a lot of respect for Hezekiah. I think he was an amazing leader. He led by example, and he really led people back to God in an amazing way. Because the king before him was a really bad king and had taken stuff out of the temple, closed up the temple, and started worshipping all the other gods around. So when Hezekiah became king, the first thing he did was to open up the temple and reconsecrate the temple, and he invited all the people, not just from Judah, but from Israel as well, to come back and worship God again in the temple. So you get this sense of this real buzz of excitement going on as people are coming back, worshipping God again, maybe the first time for a while, rededicating themselves to God. And in the midst of that worship, we read this in 2 Chronicles chapter 31, starting at verse 2. Hezekiah assigned the priests and the Levites to divisions, each of them according to their duties as priests or Levites, to offer burnt offerings and fellowship offerings, to minister, to give thanks, and to sing praises at the gates of the Lord's dwelling. The king contributed from his own possessions for the morning and evening burnt offerings and for the burnt offerings on the Sabbaths, new moons, and appointed feasts. He ordered the people living in Jerusalem to give the portion due to the priests and Levites so that they could devote themselves to the law of the Lord. As soon as the order went out, the Israelites generously gave the first fruits of their grain, new wine, oil, and honey, and all that the fields produced. They brought a great amount, a tithe of everything. The men of Israel and Judah who lived in the towns of Judah also brought a tithe of their herds and flocks and a tithe of the holy things dedicated to the Lord their God, and they piled them in heaps. They began doing this in the third month and finished in the seventh month. When Hezekiah and his officials came and saw the heaps, they praised God and blessed his people Israel. Hezekiah asked the priests and the Levites about the heaps, and Azariah, the chief priest from the family of Zadok, answered, "Since the people began to bring their contributions to the temple of the Lord, we have had enough to eat and plenty to spare, because the Lord has blessed his people, and this great amount is left over." Now, I thought that was a brilliant picture of tithing working as it should. The people brought their tithes, and because of that, the spiritual leaders of that day had enough to eat so they could concentrate on doing God's will and doing what God wanted for the people. And what I thought was particularly interesting is that it says the Israelites generously gave. And then it goes on to say they brought a tithe of this and a tithe of that and a tithe of this. And I thought, well, that's really strange, because if it was the law to bring a tithe, and that's what they did, why does it say they gave generously? And the only thing I could deduce from that is that it was actually talking about the way they give, rather than the way they gave, rather than the amount they gave. And that's what's important, isn't it? It's what's in our heart. So they gave generously, happily. It was part of their new excitement in worshipping the Lord again. It was their response to God. They wanted to give. Yes, they were told to give, but they did it because they wanted to. They gave generously. And as a result, there was plenty for the spiritual leaders and enough left over. Well, you can see the parables for today, can't you? That as we give generously, then our spiritual leaders in our church today can concentrate on what they should be doing in following God and doing what he wants. And not only that, there should be enough left over to share around so that we can also move into the town and do things in the town. Also to fund our missionaries going abroad. Also for our youth leaders, for the Marlow Vision Fund, all these different things. So by us giving generously to the Lord, we are then investing in his work in our church, in our locality, and further abroad as well. So that, I just thought, was a helpful way to look at tithing and to see how it works. So now, moving on, actually, just before I do, I just want to read that last verse again because I thought this was wonderful. Since the people began to bring their contributions, we have had enough to eat and plenty to spare, because the Lord has blessed his people, and this great amount is left over. Which brings me, very nice and neatly, to the first M of our talk. If it works, oh, gone too far. Multiplication. And that verse, the Lord blessed his people and this great amount left over, actually reminds me very much of the feeding of the 5,000, which is an example of God's multiplication. And these two stories that Collins put up here that he's chosen to illustrate this point, the feeding of the 5,000 and the widow of Nazareth, shows us the good news that God wants to multiply what we give. God's heart is to bless and to multiply. I'm sure you all know the story of the feeding of the 5,000. You may not be so familiar with the story of the widow of Zarephath, so I will just explain that one to you. It was in the time of Elijah. There was a huge famine and a drought going on in Israel, and Elijah had spent some of the time by the brook being fed by ravens, and then the brook dried up, and he had no food. So he heard from the Lord. The Lord said, go to the town of Zarephath, and there you will see a widow collecting sticks. If you ask her to give you some food to eat, then you will find out what happens. So off he goes to the town of Zarephath. He sees this widow collecting sticks, and he says, please will you give me a drink of water? So she goes off to get him a drink of water, and he says, but also, can you bring me some bread as well? And the widow says, well, actually, I've just got a little bit of oil and a little bit of flour left. I'm just about to prepare the last meal for myself and my son, and then I've got nothing. Then we're just going to die. And Elijah said, well, actually, God says he's going to look after you if you share with me. So she went back and she started to make some bread with the oil and the flour, to make some bread to share with Elijah and her son. And as she started to prepare, every time she used the oil and the bread, it carried on going, it never ran out. And so God multiplied what she used, and she was able to share with Elijah what she had, and they were kept, and God provided for them all. So these are two stories that show that God his heart is to bless and to multiply what we give. But two lessons that we learn from these. First of all, something must be blessed in order to be multiplied. In other words, we have to be prepared to give back to God in order for him to bless it. All right? We need to be prepared in our hearts to give to God if we want him to bless what we give. And secondly, only that which is given out can be multiplied. So it was in the hands of the people who gave it out. So in the feeding of the 5,000, it was the disciples who gave out the food. And as they gave it out, it multiplied as they gave. In the story of the widow of Zarephath, it was as the widow started to make the bread that it multiplied. So it was as we give out, that's when God can bless and multiply what we give. Now, one other thing I just noticed from these two stories as well is that they are both examples of people who gave sacrificially. Because it's very easy for us to say, well, okay, when I earn a bit more money, or when I've got a bit more in the bank, then I'll be able to give. And I really like to be able to give. I'd really like to be able to give, but I can't do it at the moment because I haven't got anything. But these two people just gave from what they had. For the widow of Zarephath, it was her last meal. And yet she was prepared to share it with this man that she'd never met before because she recognised that he was from God. She was willing to give all that she had. And as for the little boy and the feeding of the 5,000, he was prepared to give up his packed lunch. Well, I think that's probably the most amazing part of the story, if you ask me, if you know anything about children. If you've ever been on a school trip with children, you'll know that however amazing and fantastic the trip is, there's only two things on their mind. One is, when can I go to the gift shop and spend my money? And the other is, when can I have my packed lunch? And you're lucky if you get off the coach before them, you know, wanting their packed lunch. So for this little boy to give up his packed lunch is such an example of sacrificial giving. And I think God is saying he wants us to be generous with what we've got, not with what we might have one day if we earn enough, but actually with what we've got now. He wants us to be willing to give what we've got now, to share what we've got now. So, and if we do that, he will bless. He will bless. He will use that, what we give, to go around so much further than we think. And what we give will not only bless other people, but God will bless us too. In Luke chapter 6, it says, "Give, and it will be given to you. A good measure, pressed down, shaken together, and running over, will be poured into your lap. For with the measure you use, it will be measured to you." So God will just take the little bit that we give and use it to bless other people. But also he wants to bless us too in that act of giving. And that's good news for us too. Next M is mammon. Strange word, that mammon. It's difficult to say. Before I did this talk, I thought that mammon was just the old-fashioned King James word for the word money. But actually, when I looked it up for this talk, I discovered actually there's a separate Greek word for mammon. And it's really talking about worldly wealth, riches, and the love of money, the amassing of money, not just the coins in your purse that you take to the shop. So we're talking about worldly wealth here. And Jesus almost personifies mammon, and he makes it very explicit. There's absolutely no way that you can misunderstand what he says here in Matthew chapter 6. "No one can serve two masters. Either he will hate the one and love the other, or he will be devoted to one and despise the other. You cannot serve both God and mammon." Now, what does that mean? It means that we as Christians, where is our faith? Is it in God, or is it in that monthly paycheck that we get every week to pay the bills? Where really is our faith? Sometimes that's a difficult question to answer. It's easy, isn't it, to say, well, you know, if I win the lottery, then that's fine, you know, I don't need to worry about anything. But actually, that's not the answer, is it? Our faith needs to be in God. Now, sometimes it's difficult to actually balance these things up and actually think, where does my faith lie? Sometimes it's only when these things are taken away from us that we can actually see where our faith lies. And just to share with you, and many of you know, a few years ago, John was made redundant from his job. And he was actually out of work for about 3 years. He did get some temporary jobs in that time, but it was 3 years of uncertainty, of not quite knowing where the next paycheck was coming from. So that for us was a little bit of a time of testing. And yet, looking back on it now, we both say, although it was not something we would have chosen for ourselves, it was actually a really positive experience, because it really taught us to put our faith in God, and it really helped us with that. And it brought us closer together as well. And John wasn't just amazing in it all, I have to say. But it helped us. It helped us to put our faith in God. But right at the beginning of that 3 years, when it first happened, I remember praying to God and saying, "Lord, let him get a new job really, really quickly." And God gave me a word through someone in the church, which is another story really about being patient. And I knew from that, and it was God's way of sort of gently preparing me for the fact that it was going to take quite a while, that we were going to be a while in this situation. And I remember very, very clearly sitting at home and just sort of mulling this over and realizing the consequences of this, that it was going to be for a while, we weren't going to be quite sure where the next paycheck was coming from. And I remember thinking, oh golly, does this mean we're going to have to live by faith? And I don't know about you, but my understanding of living by faith is living on the breadline. You know, it's a thing that missionaries and poor people have to do because they haven't got any money. And always a little story always comes to my mind. I can't remember who it is. It's some famous Christian who ran a children's home. And I remember this story so vividly, I don't know why, of how he and the children were all sitting around the dinner table waiting for their dinner. And he prayed, "Oh, dear Lord, thank you for the provision of this food for our dinner," knowing full well that there was actually no food in the house whatsoever. And as soon as he said amen, there was a knock at the door and somebody arrived on the doorstep with a hamper of food. Wonderful story of God's provision. But I thought, oh my goodness, I can't live like that. It's much too scary. And I remember sort of just saying this to the Lord, and I just felt at once that peace from God saying, no, 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 that's not what living by faith means. Living by faith means that you trust in me and that I will provide. I will provide. It doesn't necessarily have to be last minute like that, but I will provide if you trust. And there were two very, very specific things that came into my mind right then that I was worried about. The first one was, at that time, our boys were at the stage where they were leaving school and going on to university. And the one thing we didn't want them to do was to come out with huge debts around their ears. We wanted to be able to fund them through university. So I thought, how are we going to do that if we haven't got the money coming in? And the second thing that I was worried about, you may think this is a bit strange or not really a necessity, but I was worried about how we're going to afford a family holiday each year, because that was important to me. And again, as these thoughts came into my mind, I wasn't even really praying them. They just sort of came into my mind as I was praying. But I just felt the Lord saying, yeah, I know those things are important to you. Trust me. I'm the one who provides. And I have to tell you that somehow or another, we did manage to pay our boys' fees. There was one year when we had two boys at university at the same time, which if any of you have been there, you know that is a real killer. And that year, my mother said to me, I'll pay for one of the boys, so you only have to find the money for one. So I know that was God's provision. And I can tell you that all our three boys now have no debts from their university days whatsoever, which is, you know, not common in these days. So I'm really grateful to the Lord for that. And as for holidays, the first year we had a holiday booked already in France. That was fine. And then the next 2 years, we had two completely separate sets of friends with holiday homes in France and with Spain who said to us, oh, you can use our homes completely free of charge. So we had two wonderful holidays in places that were probably far better than we could have afforded to go to ourselves. So God blessed. And what I learned from all of that, and why I'm sharing this with you, is that God not only provides the basics, but he wants to provide even the little luxuries as well, the things that are important to us. So living with faith doesn't mean living on the breadline. And it's not the prerogative of missionaries and poor people, but actually it's something we should all be doing all the time anyway, that our faith needs to be in God and his provision, whether or not we've got that money coming in on a regular basis. So we need to put our faith in God, not in that regular monthly check that we get, whatever it might be. But our faith needs to be in God, not in mammon. So, next slide. This is continuing with this idea. Right. Those of you who've been on the Heartstyles course, Heartstyles, is that what it's called? Yeah, probably understand all this better than I do, but I think it was clear from this slide what it's getting at, that if we live above the line, i.e. we're putting our faith in God, okay, that we will live in humility and love, and that will lead to thankfulness and generosity and giving and blessing and outwardness to other people. Living below the line in pride and fear and trusting in money and what that can do for us will only actually lead to selfishness and a bit of hoarding and actually poverty of spirit, however big your bank balance is. So that's the difference between putting our trust in God and our trust in money. Final M, motives. What flows from our heart. Proverbs 4 verse 23 says, guard your heart, for from it spring the issues of life. So what is our motive for giving? That brings us back to the beginning, really, didn't we? What we talked about it being a heart thing. What's in our heart? Why do we give? We've learned that God blesses us when we give, but is that the reason to give? Interesting one. Many years ago, I remember in the church, we used to have to listen to some of these tapes from American preachers, and there was a thing going around called the prosperity ministry, and they would say, right, you give your money to God, i.e. write your checks out to our organization at this address, P.O. Box America, and if you do that, we guarantee that God will bless you so many times bigger than however much you give. So their whole motive for giving was because we think, well, okay, if we give, then God will bless us back so many times bigger. That was the whole motive for giving. Is that right? No, that's not what it's all about, is it? We don't give for that. We don't give expecting to receive in return. And this is what Jesus says in Luke chapter 6. Give to everyone who asks you. And if anyone takes what belongs to you, do not demand it back. Do to others as you would have them to do to you. If you love those who love you, what credit is that to you? Even sinners love those who love them. And if you do good to those who are good to you, what credit is that to you? Even sinners do that. And if you lend to those from whom you expect repayment, what credit is that to you? Even sinners lend to sinners, expecting to be repaid in full. But love your enemies, do good to them, and lend to them without expecting to get anything back. So our motive for giving is not that, well, if we give, we might get it all back again. Our motive for giving is simply that because we want to give and we want to bless others just as God has given to us and blessed us. So it's our response to the goodness of God, God blessing us, that we give out to others. But then it goes on. Then your reward will be great, and you will be the sons of the Most High, because he is kind to the ungrateful and the wicked. Be merciful, just as your Father is merciful. And then, a couple of verses on, we come to the verse I read earlier. Give, and it will be given to you. A good measure, pressed down, shaken together, and running over, will be poured into your lap. So it's a full circle, isn't it? We give because God has blessed us. We give as a heart response to us. He wants us to be generous givers. He wants us to give out to other people, to bless other people in the way that he has blessed us. And we give, not expecting to get anything in return, but God, in return, blesses us. And it's a full circle. So we need to get our motives right for giving, but in doing so, we will experience the blessing of God. We will walk into that blessed life that Colin's been speaking about because of the generous heart that God has put in us. So let's allow God to transform our hearts and let's allow him to help us to walk in that blessing that he has for us. Thank you.